Hello, Mage fans. Welcome to Mage the Podcast, a podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm Adam Simpson. I'm joined by co-host Terry Robinson. And when you take your players in Sorcerer's Crusade to meet the Queen, what often happens is some of them want to charm the Queen, but the other half want to hang off the chandelier. And the question inevitably arises, can we do both? We'll look at that today on Tomes of Magic, but before we do, Terry, are there any announcements?
I guess the weirdest announcement is, so because of scheduling, this is one of those things where it's like we're recording in January for an episode that will go out in February or March. So the questions we receive, we will address in August, unless you had already given them in by last November. But my spouse recently said out of nowhere, can we play Wraith? Now, that wouldn't be a weird question if my spouse had been familiar with the panoply of games in the old World of Darkness system, but my spouse cannot reliably name the game that this podcast is about. Sometimes it'll be like, you do the Magic podcast, right? And I'm like, no, honey, it's Mage. It's all the purple books. She's like, it's the blue ones, right? I'm like, that's the other Mage. So for my spouse to suddenly be like, we're going to play Wraith. I think the embody power, the Arcanoi, that allows a Wraith to temporarily take over someone else may have been employed. But needless to say, there may be an uptick in ghost content if this winds up happening. And that is my announcement.
Hard to top that. Well, hope that is a lot of fun for you. Today on Tomes of Magic, we are looking at the Swashbuckler's Handbook for Sorcerer's Crusade. This was, I believe, the 8th book to come out in that line of 10 books. It clocks in at 128 pages. 3 authors contributed to this book. It came out in 2000, and at that point, the books for Sorcerer's Crusade were not coming out very frequently. So this was towards the end of the line. To get us started, Terry, can you consider a walkthrough for our benefit?
I would be glad to. The opening is called Prelude Cesario Dances by Phil Masters. And my notes here say, evocative, especially the sword fight in the garden. So there's a piece of opening fiction talking about a swashbuckling character who swashes buckles and then nothing really happens, which is kind of like the TLDR of this entire book, where it'll be like several pages of build up, a single event, moving on. Did you have any thoughts about the prelude? It was perfectly well written. It was enjoyable and engaging. Just not a lot happened.
I thought the prelude fiction to this was fun and actually very appropriate. This is the kind of prelude fiction I enjoy when I open, you know, the average mage book. I thought it was very clever how there is a character in the prelude fiction who knows that there is this, you know, this non-mage guy who has an amulet of protection. You know, she sets up this guy to fight with another person, and during that fight, she aims a crossbow at him but doesn't fire. So the amulet distracts him because, hey, you're in danger. And so he looks the other way. And so the guy he's actually having a sword fight with can stick him. And so I just thought it was, this prelude fiction has this really clever concept of you can manipulate protection talismans that ordinary people might have, which they can have in the Sorcerer's Crusade setting. Other books say they can have this kind of stuff. Weak magic is in the hands of a lot of ordinary people. So you can manipulate that in a certain way to get a minor advantage. I thought that was awfully clever. But yeah, like you said, it's just fun intro fiction. It was fun to read, and it fit the theme nicely. So, hey, I'm ready to move on.
The introduction is entitled Introduction. The first key bit it kind of conveys is that the Middle Ages sucked, but the Renaissance starts to bring into focus fun things like intrigue and adventure. The term swashbuckler, it indicates, is onomatopoetic and imitates the noise of a moving small shield, which requires movement and speed. Later on, it will go over the technological changes which brought about this kind of new type of sword fighting. The book bills itself as a guide to intrigue and to the Patini, the High Guild, and the Caserophi who lean on that. Mage has never really had a good way of dealing with this kind of intrigue, and I'm kind of curious to see if it lives up to it. And I kind of feel embarrassed because Adam and I have done nearly 100 of these, and I finally realized the framework I wish I had used from the beginning to appraise a book, which is basically, this is what the intro says the book is about. is the book actually about it? So for seemingly the remaining five books we have in the entire Mage line, I think one of the things I'm going to try and think of is, what did the book say it was about, and did it deliver it? And try and evaluate the book on its own terms. As always, it gives us a quick walkthrough of what the ensuing chapters will be, and that is the end of the introduction. Did you have any thoughts on the introduction?
I can just see the comments rolling in online. Hey, 100 episodes into it, and these two knuckleheads finally figured out what to do. Thanks, guys. Thanks. I think you summarized the intro quite well. I want to hear about chapter one.
Chapter one is entitled The Age of Masks. The first thing I want to note is chapter frontispieces. This book is, by and large, the art of Mark Jackson. And Mark Jackson, I think, is a wonderful illustrator. We've talked to them on Mage the Podcast before. And I just wanted to say it's got some pretty banging art, especially if you want people with swords. Like, the people with swords index is pretty high, which you would expect for a book entitled The Swashbuckler's Handbook. This is a noted departure of this, because this shows woman with things seemingly walking on the roof of a church with other people behind her. I'm not really sure entirely what's going on. It's got some real, like, Dishonored or Bloodborne vibes to it, the video game. But still, I'm liking it. And chapter one is entitled Item First, The Age of Masks. It talks about how Europe is becoming a place of intrigue because times have changed. In tribal arrangements, the groups are too small to properly do intrigue, and family and force tend to dominate. Safer trade allows a newly rich class emergence to arrive, and when people are rich, they have free time. The Ottoman Empire is strong enough that Europe is no longer dreaming of crusades, so that kind of directs activities away from that. As people get more wealthy, new indicators of class and status arrive. And in previous books, we talked about how the merchant was kind of a new figure in society. You had the priests who prayed, the peasants who worked, and the nobility that fought. And now you have traders. Italy is disorganized, but more so, it is more urban than most places. It was the heart of the Roman Empire, but even after centuries of decay, it has more left over than most other regions. Power and sophistication were important symbols, so having poets and artists on hand was kind of a sign of status. So there was a competition to have the best philosopher or artist as part of your court. It also specifically states that while the Vatican is a stronghold of religious magic, it is quite powerful, but neither the Gabrielites nor the choristers own it. I like in Mage, whenever the setting specifically says, you think there are mages running this particular thing, they're not. I think one of the neatest lines that we got through much of second edition and revised Mage was the idea that China was owned by no awakened faction, and the brief period of time where everyone was kind of in Hong Kong, assuming that everyone else was controlling the rest of China, I just thought was wonderful. We then kind of get a tour of other places throughout Europe and beyond. In England, the Hundred Years' War gave way to the War of the Roses, which ended with the death of Richard III. This war cuts across awakened lines, with order members and traditions members being on both sides. Henry VIII set himself up as the head of the Anglican Church, and therefore Protestantism was furthered, which created centuries of holy war. France, it just kind of describes as a place for war and diabolism, which I don't know if anything has changed into modern times. That is not the case. Spain is comparatively religiously diverse at the time and autonomous from the church, despite being staunchly Catholic. It prohibits foreign study, resulting in a kind of detached intelligentsia that is not in sync with the rest of Europe. It is a Gabrielite bastion and a head of action for the explorer-y types. The Celestial Chorus is heavily persecuted for its somewhat progressive religious views, and the Dedalians are having fun in the New World and growing rich. The next section we have is on the Holy Roman Empire. The HRE has more old-fashioned medieval politics, as the church is still quite powerful. Electors play a key role in picking emperors, and there is much jockeying for power. Their artistic moments are both more religious and more pagan than Italy, and the Holy Roman Empire did not necessarily see themselves as heirs to Rome and feel comfortable kind of departing from that. it gives the sense that Germany is a place to play out proper warfare between faction, launching attacks from hidden places. The Habsburgs have gained control of all electors towards the end of this period, as well as a political marriage to Spain, making Habsburg, anti-Habsburg movements and machinations to be kind of a pivotal point. The Ottomans have replaced the Byzantines. They were recently beaten by Tamerlane. This section includes a mention that his rise only could have been due to the guilds and such, which I feel is the only mention of that, and Robinson's rule. Anything that's only mentioned once in Mage is only kind of canon. I was enjoying much of the momentum of the first part, and then it starts in with kind of the semi-calculated vaguenesses that annoy the heck out of me. In the Ottoman section, it says, some of these sovereigns resort to very dark tactics indeed. Tell me what the dark tactics are. Just don't wave your hand and point to it. We get a bit on the dragon and the impaler being active in Eastern Europe. And this section, again, I found kind of infuriating because it tried to ride the line between, is Vlad the Impaler a vampire or not? And it only makes sense as a vague allusion if you already know the rest of the World of Darkness canon. But if you're not familiar with it, you're like, what is even going on here? So to me, either point to it or not, or give two or three different options of who Vlad Tepes could be. But that's me. Again, that is nearly 100 books of accumulated, just pick a side, or alternatively, give me a short list in terms of how to deal with certain vaguenesses. In Russia, the traditions in the Order of Reason are weak, and it is ruled by disparates and blood pagans, of which we get no information. I don't even know what disparates would be active in Russia. So some information there would have been good. For listeners at home, Adam is making an amazing, thoughtful, slightly confused, what disparates would be in Russia face.
I can think independent operators of this sort and that sort, but disparate group, I can't think of one at all.
It would just be great if Rus was controlled by the Kopaloe or something like that, like plot twist, or like the Sisters of Hippolyta, or just like crushing it. In the Americas at this time, the present cultures, it specifically mentions that the upper class has more rather than less restrictions on what it can do. So the notion of intrigue and swashbuckling is kind of constrained by that. This book gets confused to me in this section, as it suggests the goal of the book is to talk about maneuvering in magical societies, whereas the rest of the book kind of waffles on whether or not that's going to be the focus or whether or not it's going to be kind of about mortal machinations and such. There's a brief Africa section that just kind of gives you the state of things. It doesn't really give you much information on how you could do political maneuverings or like trade interests or anything where you could be like, okay, this is primarily a European group, but we have this trade envoy that is in the area. How can we include this? Moving on to the Middle East, it indicates the courtly intrigue is more complicated. No information is given. I do like the idea that it indicates that a successful coup shows that the person staging the coup had Allah's favor. The idea that revolution or a coup d'etat is kind of a legitimate political tool and is not necessarily frowned upon, assuming that you do it a certain way, I think is culturally interesting, and I would have liked more information about that. It indicates that European courtiers are less superstitious than Islam because the Quran has some weird stuff. I am just putting this out there. Any description of a biblical angel to me will give anything in the Quran a run for its money. So that just felt like a random thing. No mention of the Muftishah al-Nur, which I figured there would be something in here. In India, we are told that the subcontinent is chaotic, but again, we get no information on how. It ignores the advances in, say, the Kerala School of Mathematics, which would have been the forefront of the Celestial Masters. I think the subcontinent would have been a natural home to any number of courtly intrigues, especially in a period of time where, depending on when you specifically set it, would have been dominated by a dozen kingdoms at various stages of collegiality with each other. In China, there's a mention that there's a truce between the Order of Reason and the Dalai Lao Shi, which suggests that they're not the same. Like that, I wasn't quite sure what to make of that, and that interactions are highly formal. It then gives us a bunch of information about how to deal with kind of the court and courtly, that a court is an extended household, that proximity to the Lord is the sign of power, as the chamberlain who takes care of the Lord's personal affects is frequently more powerful than the formal treasurer. Other countries are going to have different arrangements. Families can be dysfunctional, and illegitimate children and cousins need to be kept in good order. there's a reference to the basics of a castle being castles and covenants when most of it's actually in Crusader lore. We get a list of jobs. Woo! I think that's kind of useful. It's a good reminder of, hey, different countries do different things. I would have liked more information because it makes reference to be like, hey, in a Ottoman household, you will have possibly these additional roles. I would have loved that page just kind of mirroring the difference, like, hey, these are positions that exist in different countries. Hey, in Korea, you have this particular spiritualist position that needs to be Africa, that needs to be included in an African court. It is very important that someone keep track of availability of water or something like that, depending on the region. I would have very much appreciated that. It mentions that courts are hard to move, but they do, and this may involve hundreds or thousands of people. The book doesn't mention this, but there's this kind of rocket equation where if each person needs help carrying their bags, eventually you start needing people to carry the stuff for the people to carry the stuff for the people to carry the stuff, and that causes the court size to really balloon. Touring was used to drain the resources of two powerful nobles without directly challenging them. So the idea is if you are a prince or a noble person for a particular region, and the king's like, this person's getting too big for their britches, or the monarch is like, let's bring them down a peg. They would pay them a formal visit and maybe is there for a week or two and just kind of drains their coffers, which I kind of liked, strategic hosting and so on. There's no rules for that. And as always, the system would have been great, but it at least gives you kind of that idea. Lesser nobles will do the same, and we get a line in the World of Darkness that the Borgias using dungeons to dispose of enemies is constant and probably the norm. When in a previous book, they're like, yeah, dungeons weren't really what we thought they were. There's very rarely any space for it. And more accurately, it's like a pantry that's particularly cold. And you're like, oh, okay, that kind of reshapes what I think of what a medieval dungeon is. It talks about merchant houses who are more willing to get their hands dirty and more likely to have earned it, which I like as an idea that, like, there hasn't been enough time for there to be the Fugger banking dynasty or something like that having existed for centuries. The royalty are protective and jealous to keep their titles, just as treaties restrict what nations do. Guild rules and charters put limitations on what guild halls are capable of. Core operation of business are built into the properties, so a merchant house is still a place of business and may still have the facilities to carry on the trade of that house. Merchants don't have traditional social roles like a lord does, so everyone's kind of figuring it out, and some people just quite simply don't trust merchants. Also, a merchant house is not open like a royal house. You can visit the house of a duke who, on certain hours, on certain days, will interact business with the public or the people that live on their land. Churches, in comparison, have communal living, with higher-ups having a little bit more space and resources. Laity, non-priestly members attend to the grounds, and maybe dens of iniquity. We get a brief mention of what magical courts are like. We get an idea of there's something called the Black Alley of Prague. I hope we get more information on that, and a very small bit on women, where there's really no option to have female characters kind of be on equal footing. Like, it's a game setting where you can teleport to space and light an airship on fire, but the idea that's like, let's just make this a more equitable setting, that doesn't seem to be on the table. And I'm always fascinated kind of by like what changes a setting is seemingly okay with and which ones they're not. We get a good rundown of courtly expectations and what kind of rules of proper courtly behavior are. I thought that was quite useful. We get information on kind of what the punishments were at the time. Things like beheading generally only came out when you formally broke the realm's rules. Below that, torture is still quite common and brutal. Imprisonment is rare, as it's hard to store people, and you need to be in this weird position where you're dangerous enough that you need to be dealt with, but important enough not to kill. Magical precautions are often taken, and broken fingers and branding is common if you are a magic user. This is interesting, as arete roles are specifically indicated as ignoring wound penalties, but branding and mutilation is sometimes used for lower crimes, or alternatively, you may choose a route of penance where you do some sort of amount of religious observance to work off your crime. Poisoning is a constant fear, and there is a brisk trade and things that protect against it. Poisoners are harshly punished, and the level of detail we get on that makes it clear that the author seemingly enjoyed that section, and I wish other sections of the book had gotten as much detail as the gruesome section on what is done to poisoners. Honor and status are important, and while we're not reaching the latter heights of it, a snub or being ostracized is something highly impactful on a person. Losing a title is very rare and requires a high crime. Banks and smiths trade on their name. Early promissory notes are circulating at this point, which depends on trust. One of kind of the overall ideas is that the rule of law will prevent violence, which is overall more rational and efficient and will help societies produce more. The rulership by power is being replaced by the idea that the kingdom is more important than the crown, and the nascent idea of the nation is arriving, that there is a cogent notion of a people. So things aren't quite completely settled, so violence is present but regulated. Duels have laws and formal code. Characters that immediately resort to violence will be kind of viewed as ruffians. This book then mentions that using social roles for social encounters aren't interesting, but I never understood that logic because we do that with combat all the time. Like, certain groups are going to want to talk out the machinations and certain groups aren't. And one of the key questions in an RPG is, what player behaviors do we want to encourage? So if someone gets to take the maximum of their player wittiness or their character wittiness, we are now excessively rewarding the character that is run by a player who is good at banter and so on, even if their character only has a manipulation of one or a charisma of two or something like that. And that's something where I wish games were more recognizing of that implicit assumption, which is fine, assuming that's what the table wants. Botches and failures on social roles may result in flaws where you have a stain upon your name or something, and we get advice on what abilities to use in certain social challenges. We are reminded that obvious magic will likely get a character put to death, and we then get a page-long future fate, which is just kind of a list of future political developments, which is like, eh. But we kind of got the frame of where things lie. Reading through the what is happening in different areas of Europe at the time, I felt like I had read that section 6 or 7 times already. It does focus on slightly different things, but there's frequently basic like biographic or demographic information that is kind of repeated in all of them. And I'm like, I wonder how it would have been different if instead of having different practice books that toured the world, you had region books that just tried to include all of it under one umbrella. But otherwise a fine chapter. What did you think of Item the First, Adam?
On page 14, there's a sidebar about chivalry and courtly love. It mentions how Sir Thomas Malory was writing about King Arthur in 1485, and he did such an awful job, he shouldn't have done that. But it does not mention that Chrétien de Troyes was writing in France between 1170 and 1190, and he was hired by Marie, Countess of Champagne, who told him what to write and how to write it. So later depictions of Lancelot and Guinevere came from de Troyes, not from Sir Thomas Malory. Criticizing Malory's depiction of Lancelot's romances without mentioning this seems to be poor research. Also, saying chivalry was a code for traveling mercenaries is very odd. Where did the author get this? It's pretty commonly documented and has been for a long time that chivalry was for landed nobility. I was disappointed to see how mages are swept along by sleeper events and have little goals or conflicts of their own. As Terry said, there's so much real-world sleeper history in this book, and it really feels like it's been repeated from the previous books, which we've been going through in this Tomes of Magic series. So yeah, there's a lot of the same historical information, and it focuses on what are the sleepers doing, when I'd like to hear how is the Order of Reason thinking about what is happening in all of these lands. Do they say, well, this event is good, but this trend is alarming, or vice versa? I mean, information like that would be more helpful to me as a storyteller. There's a section, Knowing the Dance, which is basically talking about the laws of court. And when we say court, we mean throne room, basically, or an ecclesiastical sort of equivalent of a throne room. We're not talking about tennis courts or legal courts. But I thought this section could be helpful to storytellers and players. It just quickly summarizes, these are the general things that people are trying to do. These are the things people have to be careful of, etc. That was a nice little bit. But basically, in summing up chapter one, it was interesting to read, I guess, except for the history section. But ultimately, when I came to the end as either a player or a storyteller, I don't find a lot in this chapter that is terribly useful, unfortunately. But let's take a look at chapter two.
Chapter two is entitled Item Second, Masters of the Dance, and dance is spelled with an S. We get an opening bit of fiction about a magical dress. We then get a little bit of information on the mage's role in a court. Mages may have strange arrangements at court, using the place's trade location to receive information, to test loyalties, and to meet friends. We kind of get the idea that, alternatively, political courts in the mortal world are kind of I don't want to say a neutral ground, but an area where everyone kind of understands that, one, there is an idea that mages and mortals are kind of different and that we should band together kind of out of professional courtesy, which is kind of an idea that we get in Vampire, that vampires are solitary creatures that feed on mortals, but at some point you just kind of want the company of other mages. But then contemporaneously, it indicates that groups within the courts are fiercely competitive. And I kind of get that there is a way to balance the two. I would have liked a little bit more information on that. I like ideas that there are places where the difference between different mage factions is smaller than the difference in belief between mages and mortals or mages in another group that may be active in the area. So like, where are these regions where it really is the traditions plus the Order of Reason versus some other collection of people? It indicates that courtly politics is dominated by the High Guild, the Hermetics, the Solificati, and the Caserifi. We get a shout out to House Gerbaton and Mercere. I was just pleased as punch by. Frequently, there is meddling by Infernalists who act as tempters and try and turn enemies against each other. And they're also like, you know what? Vampires. The next section, we get a bunch of information on groups that may be active in a court. Adam, would you walk us through those?
All right. The High Guild contains six guilds, but there's only one High Guild. It makes sense after you read a few hundred pages of Sorcerer's Crusade books. The six guilds are: the Resplendent Axe Guild is the muscle of the High Guild. Its members, mostly men, are chosen for their courage, strength, and size. Although used as guards and soldiers, they are mages and fully aware of the High Guild's business. Trained in combat and tactics, some members are covert agents who practice poisoning and assassination. They are usually employed by other guilds within the High Guild and often move around for different assignments. The Black Uncles, also called the Patrons Guild, carefully choose artists, craftsmen, business partners, and successors, and then give them advice and funds. Black Uncles are subtle and clever, using their magic to guide their agents in the right direction. They work through their agents, thus they are usually inconspicuous. Typical members are older mages who have had time to learn patience and gain influence. Most members come from noble or merchant families. The Royal Griffin Guild members loan money to sovereigns, banking houses, and large trading companies. They are among the richest people in all Europe. Unlike other patrons, these mages need something tangible of high worth before they loan money. They keep the big picture in mind as they use their money to build the future. They are often reclusive, but like to mix with other griffins on occasion. Albatross Guild is concerned with trade between distant locations. Members travel the world as they oversee their projects. In the process, they serve as couriers, diplomats, and ambassadors between the Daedalian lodges. Members outside Europe use animals other than the albatross to represent them. They often work closely with the explorators. The rigors of travel in this age require much preparation. Members are trained in languages, etiquette, practical skills, and different types of magic. Sun Guild members are masters of diplomacy, focusing on communication, coordination, and diplomatic ability. These mages spend more time managing finances, translating documents, and learning about mundane courts of power than fighting, but their impressive knowledge and contacts allow them to meet most any challenge. They know more than most High Guild members about what the convention as a whole is doing. The average guild house has many members of the Sun Guild. Rose Guild members are special agents of the High Guild. When an enemy needs to be swiftly removed, they are ready. Seduction, intimidation, assassination, intelligence gathering, and other needful things are their specialty. Highly trained and polished for a variety of roles, Rose Guild members are ready for any challenge. They often travel for their assignments and learn to live with danger.
We get some information also about how they approach membership, where they look for talented and ambitious youngins and face them with challenges and trials at some sort of distance, and that they are mentored actively at some point. Most must be already good at mundane social skills. The High Guild is organized into lodges and trading houses that often compete with each other. Duels of various types are sometimes used. Magistrates who lead the lodges will mediate, but can only be enforced at the highest level. So it's kind of on them to sort out most of their difficulties. Punishments are frequently in the form of large fines. The idea being, if you do something wrong, you can make up for it by proving that you're really good at your job, ergo making money. Those marked for death are merely handed over to mortals. Philosophically, they are largely humanistic and view the future as moving and changing. Their goal is to build resources that can power the agenda of the Order of Reason, whereas other wizards are often inward-focusing and solipsistic. I like their view of Daemon, that it is an inner voice guiding you. That's just another point of view. don't make it complicated. Seekings are often overcoming obstacles within one's memory palace, and they kind of have this political idea that if a single person is so valuable, then it's on them to elevate themselves. They see little benefit to the celestial masters, who are expensive but often rich. This really felt like it was foreshadowing the relationship down the line where the syndicate is like, void engineers, why is everything you do so expensive and useless? They dislike the marauders and fallen because they don't deal fairly. So I like the idea that the High Guild is like, no, we will do this by the book. There is a contract to be in place. I am bargaining with a position of vastly greater power, but once I have this agreement, I will follow it. So lawful evil, as it were, in D&D terms. The next section we get is on the Caserify. The Caserify, we finally kind of get information on them, that they were created in 1336 after the departure of the Salific Cadi. They are not just spies and assassins, but the consciousness of the Order, which to me kind of sets them up as kind of the mirror version of the Euthanatoi. They are not highly hierarchical, with no generals or leadership. Members must be able to assess things quickly and accurately. There is no actual entry information provided kind of on how you join formally. It is religious in its own way, which mixed together kind of a scientific worldview with pagan acts and mystery cults, blended in with a very mechanistic cosmos guided by God's hand. They make mention that daemons may appear in the form of bloody-handed angels, which felt like foreshadowing of Amanda Jensen's Avatar later on in second edition. They are organized into lodges of six, where only one knows all six members, but most will only know one or two others. Larger organizations may form what they refer to as a net around an area of interest, with 6 to 12 magistrates leading lodges, which implies 36 to 72 Caserify members. Their paradigm kind of revolves around the idea that we are all spies for creation, that the spy scientist and philosopher all want secrets, and the Order of Reason is a great weapon against chaos, that they are licensed to use lesser and partial truths, which is their term for kind of mystical magic. Magic, they do, needs to be able to mimic others so that they can blend in, and they tend to be a balance between the mechanical and the mystical, the vulgar and the sacred. They mention that there is an interpretation of the fall of Troy where it was done by a special illusionist trickster soldier group, which view Odysseus as having received magical tricks from Hermes. And it ties together the Hermetics, Pomegranate Dime, and the Golden Chalice within the Euthanatoi and the Caserify. This section was absolutely fascinating. I think if they had gone into more detail, it would have fallen apart, but I think it was done at an appropriate level. I think the Caserify are kind of fascinating. I would have liked more information later on their departure from the Order, because that occurs in an area of Mage where we now have really no information occurring between Sorcerer's Crusade and Victorian, by which they are clearly gone. I think they are listed as having departed in the 17th century, so sometime in the 1600s, and we just don't have a lot of magey information about that. The next section is of recurring cast, which is a collection of archetypes for use in a game based on Shakespearean characters. We also get a note on each character as to which merits may be appropriate. I think is kind of my commentary here. These entries were remarkably long for what they actually provided, which I found a little bit on the bothersome side. It is also interesting in that it's like, okay, this is Shakespearean. This is kind of towards the tail end, very much so, of the period under consideration. And it's one of those things where there's a lot of material in Sorcerer's Crusade that does not do a good job of introducing a person not already familiar with the concept to the concept, and someone highly familiar with it would not need it. So it is in a weird place where it is only useful if you need a reminder that a certain character archetype exists, and I prefer my game text to be a little more generous to someone who doesn't have the same literary or academic background as the author. So this collection of archetypes isn't quite done. The other problem with those sequence of archetypes is it results in characters that are either contrived or kind of tropes. And I just kind of want stories to be a little bit more original than that, because often when we cast characters into particular molds, we're cutting out a lot of the nuance that makes them interesting. I can come up with a character being a Romeo, which is fine, but now we've rendered that character to be somewhat one-dimensional. Adding complications and oddities and exceptions and so on, I think, are what make NPCs more alive. We then get another section on characters that you can include. We have Mother Aphra, which is a 106-year-old Caserify character, Cesario, who has no affiliation but is listed as Amor, Maximilian Wolfgang von Riesemann, who helped form the Craft Masons, then the High Guild, who lives for centuries and then dies in 1885 before Jacob von Riesemann kind of appears. We get Jukas Pacioli, who is listed as having been awakened but was not a magus, but having a powerful demon who invents double entry bookkeeping. I'm all in favor of double entry bookkeeping being the one true thing that mages have given mortals. We get Benvolio the Black Lion. We get a whole page on Machiavelli for reasons I don't understand, and Lady Carla, who believes that the Council of the Nine is doomed. We get a list of interesting events, but we never get information on them, like the Schism War, the Mercy War, the Lodge Wars, are all major events in the setting that kind of define different groups, but I don't think we've gotten more than a half page on each. We generally don't get character names to include, which to me would have livened things up a bunch. The chapter introduces a bunch of phrases that end in, but in the world of the dark fantastic, which hasn't been used a lot before and suggests systematic places where the world of darkness differs from actual history. To say that the Caserify are vague and then kind of to spend paragraphs talking about that vagueness just kind of feels like navel gazing. Just either say it's vague and move on or give us some deets. This is the chapter where it became apparent to me there are literally hundreds of scare quotes in this book where the author will be like so-called savages and so-called primitives and so-called backward people. And I'm like, we get it. And then in other cases, it's just used to describe things like when you put nobles in quotation marks, like what are you conveying there for the fourth time? So that was just kind of one of those little literary tics that kind of started to get under my skin as it went on. Otherwise, I liked the original characters. I liked the outlining of the Order of Reason groups. It makes me ache for a little more detail. I hope we get the rest of the groups in time. I'm looking forward to, I haven't read it before, but Witches and Pagans, I assume that just tells us how the Celestial Masters work. I'm pretty jazzed about that. Adam, what did you think about this chapter?
Well, it's nice that it, since it's talking so much about courtroom drama, like throne room kind of courtroom drama, it's nice that it gives us the three sort of general groups of mages that are most involved with that. One of them is the Hermetics and the Silificati together. The other is the High Guild of the Order of Reason. And last is the Caserify. I know I'm butchering that, but oh well. I think it is odd to see two conventions given detailed write-ups when the next book in Sorcerer's Crusade is all about the Order of Reason. That just seemed odd to me. I think one author wanted to do it and he wasn't assigned to the next book, so he said, I'm going for it. The High Guild philosophy section is helpful. It was nice to see that. Section on quintessence and tasks for High Guild was unsatisfying for me. Mages know what quintessence is, or they should, or I wouldn't consider them mages. Don't tell me it's just more money. Also, quintessence can be handled by mages when it isn't tasks. Does the High Guild only handle money for the Order of Reason, or quintessence also? It doesn't really get into that for us. The Caserify section, I think, is very helpful to storytellers. If a player is playing a Caserify, it's helpful for them. If they're not, then they shouldn't be reading this, but it makes sense that when you have a group like the Caserify, we've got the experts in dirty deeds. We've got people who are very well trained in spreading misinformation, spying, assassination, stealing things, all this kind of stuff. And so it's like, okay, let's get all of these people together into one group. You know what's going to happen? They're going to use their talents on each other, or probably any given one of them is going to try to take over the place. And so it's like, okay, well, how do you prevent that? Well, this section tells us how you prevent that. And the information is satisfying. It makes sense for me. I think it's well done. So I was pleased to see that. Now, what didn't satisfy me was you tell us the three groups that are involved with court intrigues across Europe. You tell us about the High Guild. You tell us about the Caserify. But the Hermetics and the Silificati, nope, let's just forget we mentioned them. It's like, dude, this is all about the mages who are manipulating nobility and clerics. So what are the Silificati and the Hermetics up to? I mean, you know, throw me a bone here. The logos behind the text in this chapter made for some difficult reading. I think the case was they had just got some layout software that enabled them to do that, and they were so excited about it that they just had to do it, and then in later years, like, it does make it kind of hard to read. Maybe we should have rethought that. So I don't want to criticize them too harshly for that, but the recurring cast section didn't seem very helpful. Maybe that's good for new storytellers. I probably shouldn't criticize it too harshly, but it just didn't do much for me. Some important figures was a section that this book needed. NPCs and what they are doing for their mage faction. This should have been a larger section. We should have had this in earlier books. The NPC bios, however, clearly favor the Daedalians. There's only one council mage mentioned, and she's a villain, that rotten villain. I love the fact that we get mages and what they're doing for their mage factions in court intrigues, but one after another, it's like the Daedalians are doing this, the Daedalians are doing that. What about the Drishans? Oh, well, there's this one, but she's a real jerk. It's like, okay, well, at least I guess it's good we got something, but oh well. So that's the good and the bad for me for chapter two. How about chapter three?
Chapter three is entitled Item Third, Hearts and Blades. And this is the practices, paradigms, and instruments section, as it were. And after a lot of buildup of Ars Cupididae, I was like, oh man, I look forward to getting a full rundown of Ars Cupididae in such a way that it explains to me how it's not just the mind sphere plus alchemy. And coming away from this section, I feel confident in saying that Ars Cupididae is the mind sphere plus some alchemy. It says that an understanding of the world so complete can grant magical powers.
That's everyone's belief! Everyone says that!
So unless you have an animistic or a holy paradigm or something, pretty well everyone is like, if you understand a thing, you can magic it. By elevating the self that you can manipulate others, that the self and others are defined clockwork and you can modify their operations, that this web of connections kind of forms a kingdom and that you can pull the strings within it to change things. And it views it as a belief that will allow you to rise above your station and manipulate the wants of others. There is also some additional pieces to it. And it says key aspects of this are rhetoric. Okay, that makes sense. We got our mind sphere right there. And then sacred geometry. And I'm like, oh, so your paradigm just includes another paradigm. I didn't know that was an option, that actions can be influenced by choosing the right price, that certain numerical correspondence allow for certain things, that angle shapes and ideas could elevate people. And I'm like, oh, that's just sacred geometry. I mean, mind you, it does have a slightly different lens, not really banging on a theistic approach as the previous presentations sometimes are. It also indicates that their tools include alchemy, memory palaces, bezoars, then charms. Yeah, so this is alchemy plus sacred geometry plus talking good. So it really left me kind of unsure of how, like, what would a mind five effect be where you create a consciousness or like any of the pattern spheres above level like two or so, or if correspondence can really be used in a way that isn't just sacred geometry. And if it's just one of the cases that at this time it is very hard or dangerous or difficult to use the mind sphere or something like that, and this is the first real paradigm that gives you an in for it, I think that would be super cool to say that, to be like, hey, at this period, the only people really good at the mind sphere are Diabolists and Infernalists who use dark seduction or entreaties with demons to influence the working of others, and masters of Ars Cupididae. And that would have been fine to me. And it just like lists a sheer number of skills that are going to be important. And it's like, okay, horseback riding, you need to tell me why that's so darn important. I get why that is socially important, but I wanted a little bit more of a direct line. We get information on Vanity and the Scourge that Ars Cupididae is subtle, but that doesn't mean that you can't arbitrarily dick over your players if you really want to. I hate this kind of advice. That's the point of a system. Quite simply, if a paradigm is too powerful, there should be some mechanical counterbalance to it. Or if it is exceptionally subtle and you want it to express in a certain way, please don't use hand-wavy storyteller advice. Give me something concrete to work with. Then we get a system of working, so effects as it were. We get Courtier's senses, which is just one dot sphere effects, which is explained away as a refined application of the senses. Sure. A lot don't actually explain Ars Cupididae, just that you're borrowing effects from other worldviews. Like Luster is a matter two effect, which uses alchemy, which is just using alchemy. We do get some basic systems that could support things like spreading a rumor, which is kind of cool, and it requires some existing skills as well. So as happened previously with a lot of technomantic activities, it is really the superpower being magic to improve vastly a attribute plus ability roll. And we get some systems for poisons. Hooray! We also get a few rotes on the Byzantine magic of Ixos, like Silent Circle to use grave dust to silence an area and as a way to send people to sleep. Morpheus's Kiss sends people to sleep if the mage rolls above their willpower, which is always one of those annoying things where you're like, okay, so we now have a magical effect with difficulty two. So we more or less get the Agama Ray Sojourn, which Euthanatoi will later use to descend into the underworld as part of their initiation. But in the guise of the Xerophi walking through the underworld, like, holy dink, just using Spirit 3 is so much easier than Spirit 3 Life 2 Entropy 4. This rote even disagrees internally with whether or not the person actually disappears or people just kind of ignore them. I feel like that's a thing where we should have a definitive answer as to what happens. We get some information about backgrounds going up to 10. Patron is an idea of someone who will support you. Retinue is a group that follows you to support you with many common abilities and a few acceptable ones. We get wonders like a disguise kit, a sword breaker, a clockwork modification device, and something that adds to your social pool. This chapter kind of left a weird taste in my mouth, like you just had a cookie that was made with shortening as opposed to butter, and you're just kind of like, this makes for great audio, I understand. It's a start. Give me some more on Ars Cupididae. It's a lot of flowery things and like hand waving, and for me to run it as a storyteller, I need there to be a bit more of a nut to it. I didn't get enough advice on what a seeking would look like. It really just sounds like a paradigm for self-important characters to use up to like a Rite 4 or 5 before the wheels really kind of come off. That was my feeling of things. Adam, what did you think of this chapter?
Really odd quote on page 80. But whereas the alchemist strives to turn base materials into perfection, the Floriatus tries to perfect himself. Several mage books before this in Sorcerer's Crusade have stated that the true goal of alchemy is to perfect the alchemist. It's surprising an editor didn't catch this one.
It really felt like Ars Cupididae was misunderstanding other people's paradigms for fun and profit. But yeah.
The info on Ars Cupididae did also strike me as Terry said, flowery hand-waving. But then I kind of perceived it that way to begin with. So although it was a little disappointing to me, it was not a big disappointment to me. I think it's interesting that the info on Ars Cupididae doesn't shy away from mentioning pride, manipulation, and temptation at the heart of this style. I understand why mages on both sides of the Order Traditions conflict would want to avoid using Ars Cupididae. Think about the resonance. For those who want to portray the Syndicate in modern times as a bad bunch, it makes sense to have a negative approach to magic influencing them for centuries. So yeah, that kind of moral angle to it I found very interesting, and it did explicitly mention that in the text. All the rotes except one of the ancient Greek ones is below level 4. Is that because Ars Cupididae is so new? Or is that because the developers wanted it to be low powered? I don't know. A note from the developer would have been great there, but we don't have one. The tools section has some handy items, but nothing really groundbreaking. There's a section on folk charms, sort of a sidebar about that. It was interesting, but it doesn't even suggest any kinds of rules for their use, which would have helped me as a storyteller, actually. Folk charms is something I have never really read about. I realize that they are used by folks in the Renaissance era. I just know next to nothing about them. And so this sidebar says, hey, what about those? I'm like, well, tell me, what about them? give me some kind of suggestion about rules. You don't have to lay out everything, you know, step by step, but, you know, give me something. They have some talismans towards the end. The sword breaker and thief's claw. The sword breaker is kind of a handheld weapon you can enter a sword fight with, and during the fight it changes and you can grab or take away or just bust your opponent's sword. And I thought that was pretty cool. The thief's claw is a sort of Renaissance-era multi-tool for people who are up to no good. It has all these different parts and pieces. You can, like, spin it around like a big clunky ring, and there's things you can break off and use it to get around locks and to get into places where you should not be. So I thought that was pretty cool. Well, I'm taking over the walkthrough for chapter 4. I don't really have a reason. Terry catches a lot of details and his wit is appreciated by our listeners. Consider this a visitation of Scourge, something unexpected. Chapter 4 is storyteller advice and called Honeyed Words and Bitter Poison, which would seem to indicate storytellers shouldn't be trusted. I'm sure the authors were just joking around. I mean, storytellers are just decent people, aren't they? We kick it off with the ongoing fiction about Maria and Gareth. This fiction is a good example of a court-centered story, but not so much for swashbuckling story. Weaving the plot advises us the storyteller and players should agree on styles and themes to avoid trouble. I agree with his advice, but want to add interesting things can happen when you ease off on style and let the players hash out a style of their own. Also, I shift mood and style so often, I don't like to declare them up front. From here, we move to the meat of the chapter. 11 plot templates taken from Shakespeare's plays. I've heard Mage fans say, the Sorcerer's Crusade authors are good, but they're no Shakespeare. The authors must have heard the same thing, because here they reply, oh, you want Shakespeare? Here's 9 pages of it with commentary to show we know our Shakespeare. The point of this is to give ample examples of court-centered stories, which may differ from the sorts of stories the reader has been running. Stories that center on a covenant or a traveling cabal likely don't have themes of subtlety or focus on sleeper nobility that are key to court-centered stories. The authors are making an assumption here that may not be correct, but the likelihood is high, so it's understandable. The dramatic style offers strong plots and strong passions. Hamlet shows courtly revenge, Romeo and Juliet shows personal tragedy, King Lear is grand tragedy, Coriolanus focuses on politics, while Much Ado About Nothing is comical drama. This last section gives a nice shout-out to Kenneth Branagh's 1993 movie of the same name. I have it on DVD. I love that movie. One of the few films I can watch repeatedly. Keanu Reeves gets teased for his performance, but I thought he did great. Terry is signaling. Oh, right, chapter 4. Historical style guides us to compelling stories that involve famous people and events. Henry V offers politics and war. Henry VIII is the pageantry of the past, while Richard III delivers the shadows of history. The magic style features spirits, spells, and secrets. Can you introduce spirits, spells, and secrets into a game about wizards who visit the Umbra? Some say that's what the whole game is about. All joking aside, it's worth mentioning here, this book was released in 2000, a time when Revised Edition was redefining Mage as a game with less flashy magic and a more down-to-earth approach. Also, the Sorcerer's Crusade books preceding this emphasize sleeper history and politics and how mages blend into that. So it isn't ridiculous to offer some examples of big magic and strange spirits. A Midsummer Night's Dream is magical comedy. Macbeth shows us malign interventions, that is, supernatural actors stirring up a mortal court. The Tempest gives high magic. I enjoyed the authors straying a little off the trail in this section by remembering mages have their own courts. The Order of Reason has their White Towers, while the Council of Nine has Horizon Covenant and Doicetep. Magic is more out in the open at these places, but subtlety and intrigue are still found here in ample supply. My criticism here is this section assumes magic only comes from mages. This fits in with the Mage Modern aesthetic that was well underway in 2000. To sum up my thoughts on the 11 templates, it was enjoyable reading with a few possible ideas for games. However, I don't find it terribly useful. Many of these things we can come up with on our own, although nice, it's actually kind of forgettable. A sidebar called Deus Ex Machina gives storytellers 6 sudden events they can use as an emergency break when they want to stop a mounting disaster in their game that comes from unexpected player decisions. New storytellers will probably appreciate these. Not vital for experienced storytellers, but handy and appropriate for this chapter. The chapter winds down with 4 pages on genre standards. It gives advice on how to avoid presenting them as cliches. There are 4 standard scenes for court dramas, 3 for swashbuckling stories, and the unearthly encounter can work for any kind of game. This advice is good. It's rather vague, and most storytellers are already familiar with these kinds of scenes, but new storytellers may benefit. I think storytellers shouldn't worry so much about properly conforming to a genre. This can help us get our games out of a rut, but honestly, how many of us have run so many Sorcerer's Crusade games that we have a rut to get out of? A section helps us keep the standard NPCs of political stories from getting stale. There's some advice on using politics to add ambiguity to the plot. Another section advises us to use NPCs as patrons and allies to help get the players into court-centered stories. These sections are good advice. I'm not going to criticize them, but again, it isn't really vital or surprising stuff. A sidebar offers us a list of settings and complications you can try in those settings. This seems like obvious stuff to me, but could be helpful to new storytellers. Now that I've walked us through Chapter 4, I should probably make peace with Terry and ask, Terry, what did you think of Chapter 4?
Chapter 4 was interesting in that I think this is one of the first examples, or this is part of a relatively small collection of books that to me had really solid storyteller advice. Now, mind you, the entire chapter wasn't amazing. The potential plots are very vague with very little useful advice. We get a concrete list of ways to shift a plot that's erred, which I think is very useful. The section often requires you to remember Shakespeare plays, which just kind of smacks of someone not having run Mage and again presuming a certain level of cultural familiarity of their readers, which I don't think is necessarily reasonable. The standard scenes I very much liked, and on page 119, we get the single most useful page that has come as a storyteller reference in the form of that classic settings and complications listing. Again, this deals with the fact that, as with all things that occur in the latter half of a book in Sorcerer's Crusade, the templating is just terrible. It's like, this is literally a list. Man, could indents, like maybe we bullet it or something like that. It is weird to me that the author seemed very comfortable with cliche characters, but is pushing back against cliche events, where that just feels like an arbitrary choice to me. I get bored by obviously stereotyped or archetypal characters in most cases, but I less have a problem with kind of cliche scenes because there is a reason that they are cliched. They get used because those kind of events can occur a lot. So I kind of disagree with the authors kind of there. Again, I will push back against any book that tells me to kind of pick a theme and stick with it. Life is rarely that polite, and this kind of comes out of a school of storytelling that indicates that it is the role of the storyteller to come up with a masterpiece and players have their part to play, but really you should kind of exclude them because they may mess up your story. So like Adam says, my games tend to change genre, theme, and mood. There may be a core that it returns to, but from session to session or from scene to scene, it may change up because that's frequently what feels natural, what the players are interested in, kind of how life works. But I would say that this is kind of an unusually good storyteller advice chapter. Speaking of templating, the item fourth, honeyed words and bitter poison, barely fits into the top of each page. It's really, they're really cramming it in. So Adam, you did the walkthrough. What did you think of this section?
Like you said, I think it is good storyteller advice. I've been running games for a while, and so a lot of this was like, yeah, I know that. But after reading the chapter, I had to stop and say, well, you know, come on, this is not written for people who've been running these kinds of games for so many years. This is for people who are kind of new to it, or people who want to try something different, and they haven't tried something different before. They've only run games a certain way, and they want to branch out. And so, yeah, for that, it is a good chapter. I think there is some good advice here. And that sidebar on how to slam on the brakes when your players do something really weird and things are just, you know, tipping, you know, the table's about to tip over metaphorically. And so that was quite useful. If I was a new storyteller, I would read that and I'd go, oh, yes, thank you. I wanted that. So yeah, there's definitely good material here.
The next section is the appendix, which at least in the PDF comes after the back cover. So that is a stylistic choice to be like, here's the book, and then here's several additional pages. We get a bunch of classic maneuvers that can be used in combat, rules for merely dazing someone instead of killing them, which I think is great. We get a blade fodder system, which quickly deals with a large number of people in an encounter, and I think these are good. How to do your chandelier swing, how to hit someone in the head with something, which is good. I think these are all useful. The only kind of downside, looking at these mechanically, it is frequently more expeditious just to stab a guy, which is kind of the Swashbuckler's Handbook equivalent of my fondness in M20 for invoking the 10th sphere, the sphere of gun, which frequently just kind of solves things. Things like headbutting people, it's kind of useful, but like, I think the counterbalance to a maneuver is you need to give scenarios where the default that you would normally do either can't be done or would be highly disadvantageous if successful. We need to come up with more scenarios where it's like, no, headbutting a person makes more of an effect. Or for instance, the cut the Z, which is the with a flourish of your blade on a flat surface, you can leave a permanent reminder of your skill involved. Be like, oh, going forward, if you successfully do this against someone, you will probably gain +1 status in the court. or future magical effects that you do embellish your swordsmanship may come across as coincidental. I wanted more of a toolbox to justify maneuvers. Otherwise, it is a case where people are choosing the mechanically disadvantageous action because it is dramatically appropriate. And if it does something like decreases damage or increases difficulty, you're now punishing the player for trying to do something cool to add to the story. The way other games will tackle this is, no matter what, you're making the same basic roll, and if your roll is really good, now you get to add the flourish to it. For instance, Feng Shui is a good example of this, the game by Atlas Games, where if you want to do the kung fu maneuver of like running up the bullets that are being fired at you to kick someone in the face, instead of starting with that, you roll, the storyteller is like, man, you got 5 successes. What cool ass thing do you want to do? You say, I'm going to run up the bullets and kick the guy in the face. Because the problem with doing it the first way is if you fail, you're the guy who failed to run up the bullets, which probably involves being shot a lot, which I imagine is quite painful, even in an RPG. So that's just kind of me. That was my thought on the appendix. What did you think on the appendix, Adam?
Yeah, I thought the appendix was useful. 6 pages of stunts. I thought it was kind of funny that this is the only like directly swashbuckling material in a book about swashbucklers. But yeah, I thought the stunts were good. I think it's good for spicing up fight scenes. I think they can add fun. And I think for me, what helped was a bit of a perspective on, I guess you could say, the genre of swashbuckling. The movies and stories that made the idea of swashbuckling popular had kind of 2 things going for them. One, a lot of the movies were made at a time when studios felt some pressure, real or not, to show less violent action movies to the public. And so you have the swashbucklers dropping drapes and curtains on people's faces instead of stabbing them in the gut and stuff like that. And so that, well, it increased comedy potential also to entertain audiences. But I mean, it was a time when it's like, hey, can we have an action scene without a lot of blood? Is there a way to do this? And swashbuckling was kind of an answer for that. Modern movie making has different concerns surrounding it. But the other thing is, a lot of the famous swashbuckling stories were the story of a hero who wants to push out 1 or 2 bad leaders at court. But everybody else there, they not only liked them, they were trying to win their support. One of the big swashbuckling heroes of fiction, not history, but fiction, was Robin Hood. He wanted to kick out the Sheriff of Nottingham, the bad king, and 1 or 2 other people. But everybody else in the kingdom, he not only didn't want to hurt them, but he wanted to gain their support so that they could bring back the king that Robin Hood wanted to be there. And so when he showed up and he had to knock out a whole bunch of guards and upend everything that everybody's doing, the less people he kills, the less people he injures, the easier it is to get the support of the popular people. And so when you have those 2 kind of elements in your tool bag to approach a swashbuckling story, it's like, okay, maybe this is why we want to do a goofball stunt that's harder rather than just stab the guy with your dagger. Okay, he's down. Okay, stab the next guy with your dagger. Okay, he's down. Now the king's going to listen to you. It's like, yeah, well, the king will listen to you. But as soon as he's done listening to you, everybody in the kingdom is going to say, wow, that guy's a murderer. He's awful. I don't want him influencing the king. Yep. Maybe we could get rid of him in the middle of the night because he's dangerous. So that's kind of the context, I think, of swashbuckling stories. So I guess now it's time to look at general thoughts for the book. Terry, what did you think of the book as a whole?
As I mentioned, many early sections were retreads of what we had seen before with a slight spin. I swear I've read the same paragraph about the Ottoman Empire 4 times at this yeah. point with a different kind of like ending sentence. The bit on how a royal household works is, I think, literally a retread of a retread. We got some information in Crusade lore, and then we also got it later in The Companion. This book reminds me of a lot of things I eventually grow to dislike in M20. The imprisonment section gives you examples that are all references to historical or literary events. And if you just don't know them already, there's nothing useful there. And if you already know them, then you already know them. Again, at best, it is a reminder. I was excited to learn about Ars Cupididae. I thought Ars Cupididae was going to be more. I do think there is an interesting idea, as Adam mentioned, to be like, oh, within period, there aren't a lot of 4 or 5 dot effects because the paradigm hasn't been around long enough to figure it out. It hasn't given way to hyper-economics or something like that. And I thought that would be fascinating. And I think that's a really cool angle. I just would have wanted that spelled out. Adam has also proposed the idea before that there are certain things like street magical paradigms that are really good at those 1, 2, and 3 dot effects, but really struggle for things higher than that. That is an idea that you can introduce into your game. You kind of have to bring your own, though, and it's kind of an apologetics. It is a justification after the fact. It is an interesting idea. I would have liked more information on that high end, which is in contrast to other cases. Periodically, we get a books where they're like, here's a bunch of rotes that can only be done by archmasters. Also, this group has only been around for 10 years. And you're like, how do you have 10-year-old archmasters? Anyway, I thought the Caserify were absolutely fascinating. To the surprise of no one, the group that combines the interest of the Hermetics with the mysticism and like conscience of the Euthanatoi, two things I love about those groups. It's very much a case of you got chocolate and my peanut butter. I'm split on the constant Shakespeare references. Like he's comes after the era. It's an interesting framework, but I mean, oh man, sometimes it digs deep. I don't know how many people out there are going to be like, oh yeah, your Coriolanus reference really, really hit. We get no information on the Sileficati at this point. As I see the end of Sorcerer's Crusade, there's really so when are we going to get to the fireworks factory moment that I'm having about the Sileficati, where it's like, oh yeah, they're rich and mystical and we're not in any way going to describe them. And I just need enough to differentiate them from Hermetics. Just give me that much. Otherwise, I thought the book was fine. I don't think it quite delivered on what it was trying to do. I think it got probably 60 or 70% of the way there, which is better than some books, not as good as others. I loved the walkthrough of the High Guild. I thought that was pretty fascinating. It did a good job to me of outlining paradigmically where they are interesting and unique and where they probably differ from the modern syndicate. Like, so the idea that their belief that self-improvement is a thing that can happen and that wealth and skill are signs of that, as opposed to just signs of divine favor, I think is philosophically fascinating. They also kind of take a step away from the religiosity of a lot of other parts of the Order of Reason. And they're like, yeah, we're going to go to church, but I'm not going to lie. We're probably going to be thinking about a dirty joke or a weird story someone told me during the sermon or something like that. And I am perfectly fine with that. What did you think overall, Adam?
The opening fiction and the title say this is all about the swashbuckler, but it seems to be more about court intrigue. I mean, if they called it the Courtier's Handbook, you know, it seems like it would have made a little more sense for me. But they did have some swashbuckling material, and so that's good. I'm not going to just flat out complain against it. But I like the book. I liked reading it. I think there's some really good writing in here. When I'm done, there are a few useful bits. I wish there were a lot more useful bits. I mean, when you enjoy reading a book that much, you expect to get to the end and say, yeah, great book. Instead, it's like, well, it was a fun reading experience, but there were some useful things in it. I wish there had been more. I think court connections allow storytellers to use amusing NPCs that would otherwise get ignored by the players. You can think of a real, you know, comical NPC who's a short guy with a big nose, and he's constantly talking about how awesome his falcon is, and he was bragging about it. And your players are going to be like, this is a loser, forget him. And that's the end of it. But if this, you know, short guy with a big nose is the nephew of the queen, now all of a sudden the players are like, all right, I guess we better make friends with him. And you can use all these, you know, funny, quirky little NPCs you'd like to play with, and the storyteller, I mean, the players have a motivation to put up with them instead of just say, forget that. So we're 8 books into Sorcerer's Crusade, and the next one is on the Order of Reason. It's clear the Sorcerer's Crusade writers really like writing about the Order of Reason. I'm beginning to forget the traditions are in this game. With this much focus on the Halls of Power, I would have liked to have seen a little more mention of vampires. It did mention vampires. It just seems like if you're talking about influencing small noble courts and clerical courts, it seems like you'd run up against vampires more. So I would just like to hear, what is the High Guild advice on? If you run into a vampire, think about this. Or the Caserify standard operating procedure. What is the advice they give their agents? Oh, if vampire do this, I mean, would have been good. This book makes it clear money is the unit of exchange between mages. So this is a little bit of a different thinking from earlier approaches to mage society and mage priorities. There are some typos and dumb jokes in the rules section that require some patience from the reader. The book is perfect. I guess that pretty much sums up my thoughts on the book. I think we've discussed it pretty well. Terry, was there any quote that just jumped off the page for you?
There was. Sometimes they pick funny ones. Sometimes they pick pithy ones. This one, I thought, just elucidated kind of a worldview well. And this is when two characters are talking about a guard against poison. And one says to the other, "I think," said the alchemist, "that we can discuss satisfactory arrangements regarding paying for the bezoar. As we both know, the cost of science is far lower than the cost of superstition." And there are two ways to take that. One is it is fiscally or financially cheaper to support science at this point than it is to have a court astrologer and a court alchemist compared to just having someone doing simple natural philosophy, but also the long-term view that ultimately the cost of science as a paradigm is lower than the cost of superstition. The universe will not kind of support you in a superstitionist way where it does in the sciences. And I thought that was one of those things where you get a sentence that kind of accurately outlines a paradigm of a group and also foreshadows how the next few centuries will unfold. So that one struck me.
Definitely. Well, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a positive review for Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in other people's searches. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes we prepare for you. We have a YouTube channel now where you can find our episodes. There's a link in the show notes, but you can also search YouTube for Mage the Podcast. All lowercase, don't sweat the colon. You'll find us. This episode was assisted greatly by our executive producer, Terry. Can you share the names of these people?
I would be glad to. I would like to thank Oracle Sean Gallagher, Oracle Benjamin Bendelow, Oracle Buck Gregory, Oracle Christopher Phillips, Oracle Josh Hillerup, Oracle Neil Patterson, Oracle Jay Widener, Oracle McCarroll, Oracle the Crew of Erebus, Archmaster Andrew Andelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsick, Archmaster Guy Conan Stewart, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Patrick McNamara, as well as Alex Alexia, Andrews S. Anon, Bedurfee, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Boogers to the Six, Brendan, Bryce Perry, Chris B., Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scrimner, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Fragorock, George Laura, Eable, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, John Magnuson, Julian Andes, Lols and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Nikita Klemenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Puka G, Rachel Grace, Ralph Scheinhammer, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H, Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, William Connolly, William Martin, and Zach Rules. Thank you so much for your support.
If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing shows like this one. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
Go change reality, possibly by a strategic application of staring into someone's eyes in such a way that they'd go, "Ooh, this person probably is better at me than fencing," and also understanding how much an opal will trade for. I should listen to them. Bye.